Welcome to the RD2B podcast. Each week, we sit down with a different registered dietitian nutritionist to showcase the diversity of opportunity in the dietetics profession. Our aim is to dismantle the notion that there is a traditional career path. I'm Carl Barnes, the registered dietitian behind the scenes of RD2B.
And I am Jenna Warnock, the RD2B host. Our RD guests share their stories, career paths, and advice to help students like us succeed in the profession. Welcome back to another week of the RD2B podcast. I'm your host, Jenna, and this week we're super excited to feature a pretty underrepresented topic in nutrition regarding communication. And we have the best representative for this topic, Barb Mayfield, and she's the president of Nutrition Communicator, and she's also the editor-in-chief for the Academy's publication, Communicating Nutrition, the authoritative guide, which is like the one-stop shop for if you want to know how to communicate effectively in a nutrition concept and just exactly, how to be a good nutrition communicator. It's just the great way to kind of get your feet wet, and definitely encourage everyone to read it when they can. And so, Barb, thank you so much for joining us to talk about not only your book, but your path and just all the wonderful things you've done in your career. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. I love doing this.
Yes. And so the first question that we kind of want to just kind of like lay the groundwork for, given that it'll be about nutrition communication, is first, how would you define communication?
Well, when I saw that question, I'll just full disclosure, you sent me some of these questions in advance, which is very nice. Not always happens in an interview. And I thought to myself, well, we wrote that in chapter one of the book. So I looked it up on page 8, and here we go. This is communication according to Communicating Nutrition. Communication is the act of transmitting or exchanging, I like that word even better, exchanging information, thoughts, ideas between a sender and one or more receivers. You probably find that in most books. Now, keep in mind that the term is used beyond the act of that for the message itself, for the means used for transmitting the message, and even for the whole field of study encompassing the exchange of ideas and messages. To go beyond that, a couple of other points that we make in that very first chapter and emphasize throughout the book is that everything we say and do, even silence, is communication. And that's why we even titled the chapter Communication is the essence of nutrition practice. To live, this is a quote from that chapter, to live is to communicate. Now, one of the other main points that we make in the book is that communication is relational. We tend to focus on messages and content, blah, 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 but it's more than a message. It's a human interaction, and you cannot not communicate. So probably more of an answer than you expected, but again, just to rephrase what we have in the book. And that's a very fundamental, I'm glad you asked that question first. It's good to start at the foundation.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that, again, you not only covered, because I feel like everyone hears communication, but whenever you cover the nuances with it, where it's not only an interaction, it's an exchange, and it's like a foundation of what everyone does in no matter what context they're talking about, but especially in nutrition, it's like literally the foundation of how we are effective practitioners, how we actually do our jobs, and how it translates into everything. But just given your experience and given how well you are with teaching communication and knowing how important it is, if like say a nutrition student is just listening to this and they're like, yeah, I hear about it all the time, but it's just, you know, it's not my strong suit, I just don't really care about it, why should we care about nutrition, and I mean communication nutrition in the space, and how can you get someone excited about learning more about it?
I like to say this all the time, and it's often a part of a presentation I give or an article I write to someone like yourself and the people listening. You are the future nutrition professionals, but this message is to also current RDNs and nutrition professionals. You came into the field to change lives. And so in school, you are becoming, and you continue to pursue being a food and nutrition expert. Your knowledge is your tool that you use. But without the ability to communicate what you know, your ability to impact those lives and to influence change is really minimized. You can know something, but if you can't translate it to an audience in a meaningful way, it may not do that much good. I love a quote, and you know me, I love quotes. Arthur Chris Gardner puts it this way: if you can't communicate, it doesn't matter what you know. So as guidance to a future nutrition professional and existing ones, as you build your knowledge of food and nutrition, as you become that food and nutrition expert, build your knowledge and skills in communication right alongside it so that you're a communication expert as well.
Yeah, and I think it's just so great to emphasize why it's important, just because, like, exactly what you said, if we don't know how, our knowledge and our expertise won't go anywhere. Like, we'll have that credential, but that's going to be it. Like, we won't be able to actually use it effectively and use it how it's supposed to be. And for you personally, just kind of, because I'm glad that we established the foundation of what communication is, how it's used in the nutrition space, why it's important. And so now that we kind of have a good foundation about that, I really do want to dive into your personal and professional background as to just how you became such an expert in this space. And so your emphasis is very much primarily through communication, through education, and everything revolving around that. And so can you describe how your passion, kind of where it started and how it translated into pursuing it in dietetics?
Absolutely. And as I share this, I want you to reflect on your own journey and the things that have resonated with you from the time you were a little child and some of the opportunities you've had and where you have felt in your zone, or you've really felt like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. Because that's really my story. And I think it's most people's story if they really pay attention. So from an early age, I've always loved teaching and, I don't know, sharing about things. Okay. And so from an early age, and you can read my journey actually on my website, I have it described and I have some photos, but from a fairly early age, I think I was about 12, I would run a summer camp in our backyard in Ithaca, New York, where I grew up. And I was also, over the period of those years, I would be a camp counselor. I was a nanny for several families. I would go there after school, or I did it in the summer. So being with kids and teaching kids has always been a real passion of mine. But I also like to teach adults and anyone. You give me something to teach about and I'm in my happy place. Well, when I was nannying and also just in my own home, I also loved to cook and come up with recipes. And I would cook for these families just because I did. And so those families actually encouraged me to pursue that as a college degree. And so I looked into places where I could study foods and nutrition and it could become a profession in the sense that I might be the director of the Good Housekeeping Institute and write cookbooks and things like that. And Purdue University was one of those places. It had a major called Foods and Nutrition and Business. And so I went to Purdue with that major and fell in love not only with my foods classes, but also with my nutrition courses. And my advisor said, you should double major in foods and nutrition and business and in dietetics. Get the dietetics credential because that will be in your favor. And it's only like two classes different. And I also then minored in communication because, again, I went there wanting to like write for magazines and be on television. And so this is before Food Network. This is in the 1970s, mind you. So that was my path. And as I went through school, the idea of having the RD credential, wasn't RDN at that time, that was a priority. I thought this really is going to make a difference. Even though I never had an aspiration to be a clinical dietitian and never have worked in a hospital. I was a candy striper in high school. I did that too. But that wasn't my thing. And I will often tell students, there are a lot of ways to practice in nutrition and lots of RDs are clinical dietitians, but that doesn't mean you have to be. I also had, while I was at Purdue, we had a guest speaker from the Dairy Council talk about nutrition education, and my eyes lit up. And it was like, I want to learn more about this. And so as I was finishing my degree, at the time that I became an RD, you could go to graduate school and accrue various types of experiences and get that okayed by the American Dietetic Association at the time and sit for the exam. So that is not a pathway that exists anymore. But I went to graduate school at Cornell, which, if you remember, I said I grew up in Ithaca, New York, was going back home. And I got a degree from their nutrition department with a focus on nutrition education with communication as a minor. And by the way, the first chapter in the book was written, co-authored with my major professor from Cornell, Ardith Gillespie.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I think it's, so just kind of going through your entire just kind of upbringing with nutrition, dietetics, and communication, it just seems like ever since you were 12, communication, education has just been at the forefront. And so it sounds like communication has just always been something that's come naturally for you, and that it was more so just, and again, you can feel free to expand more on where it came from, how it grew, and just kind of if you could go more in depth about how you cultivated that communication skills and how you made it a greater strength, because I'm sure some people, they might be listening and they'll be like, oh, she's been doing it since she was 12. She's the expert. I'll never be able to get there. But just so that you can kind of like dismantle that notion some people may be having, if you could just dive deeper into how you strengthened that communication skill and how anyone can do it.
That is a question that I really think everyone needs to like look in the mirror and say, I can be a better communicator. I wasn't a Food Network star at age 12. I was just on that pathway. And I haven't ever been a Food Network star. Things have gone different directions. And we'll talk more about that. But I had an interest. I think I had a knowledge of how important it was to do that well. Okay. So that was the seed that I had that was planted. But to quote the book again, Ellie Krieger, who you may or may not be familiar with, who is a Food Network star and also a graduate of Cornell, she says it this way. She wrote our foreword. While it might seem like some people just have a natural knack for communicating, much of it is a learned and practiced skill. No one starts out a communications expert. You get there by stepping into the ring and keeping at it, integrating the tools of the trade and building your skills along the way. You learn it by doing it. Sure, a book is great. I totally suggest that you read it, study it, but that isn't enough. You have to do it. And by doing it, and sometimes you do it afraid, and confidence follows. You learn by doing. I am still a member of a Toastmasters club and have been for going on 25 years, I think. And it's a place where I practice my communication and help others to be better communicators. So there are ways to continue to learn even after you get your credential. And I encourage you to do so and try new things. When I went to school, there wasn't social media. There wasn't even PowerPoint. We taught with overhead transparencies and chalkboards. And things in your lifetime will also continue to evolve and change. And you need to learn how to use those tools.
Mm-hmm. And it's so, and I'm so glad that, again, and I love how you're using those quotes and you're just using those references, because it just adds and reinforces so much how, like, yes, no one's born a communicator, they're made a communicator. And it's so just accurate and encouraging for everyone to know that they can improve their communication skills. And so I'm so glad that you actually brought up Toastmasters, because I went to FENCE for my first time this year. And I heard from like three different dietitians, they're like, Toastmasters, Toastmasters, Toastmasters. And so I was just wondering, I think this is just a great kind of point to, for maybe aspiring RDs, current RDs, for ways that they can get out in the ring, because I feel like a lot of people, they're like, yes, I know, I need to practice, I need to da-da-da, like, you know, it's like, I know, but it's kind of the, where do you do it? And I think Toastmasters, because I heard about it recently as well, but if you could just kind of like describe what it is, as well as maybe other ways that people can improve their communication skills and where they can improve it.
Well, Well, number one way is say yes when someone asks you to write that blog, or within reasonable boundaries. I mean, you don't overextend yourself, but if you want to get better at a TV interview and the local TV station calls and says, will you talk on this subject? If you know something about it, say yes, because it's through, again, what I said, through doing it that you really learn. But there are also, I do coaching. There are other people that coach in speaking, and you don't necessarily have to do it with a nutrition person. But Toastmasters is an organization that is all around the world. Okay, so no matter in the community, I live outside of where Purdue is, outside of Lafayette. I think we have 6 or 8 clubs in our area. Okay, so you can probably find one that meets at the time of day or day of the week that's convenient for you. So that's one reason that is recommended so highly. It's also quite affordable. It's an organization that's been around for almost 100 years. I think it'll be 100 next year. And it was started as a public speaking organization for you to learn public speaking, but it has expanded beyond just communication to also leadership. And so those are its real strong suits. And it's a hierarchy. There's an international organization and regional and districts, and you can get involved at all levels. But a small club like ours, most of them are under 20 members. Ours is, I think, currently around 12. We're actually, ever since COVID, we've become a hybrid club. You could even join our club as long as you could meet at noon Eastern time on first or third Wednesdays. And we also meet in person. But I would say about 2/3 of the people meet over Zoom. And so we have an OWL, one of those devices that allows you to see the people in the room as well as on the screen. Technology like what we're doing today is so amazing. What we can do that when I was going to school, these things didn't exist. We had the radio. We learned about being on the radio, but that a podcast is just a whole different thing. So again, do it. Try things, be willing to make mistakes, learn from them, keep trying, you'll get better.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I'm glad that you described more about Toastmasters and how it's everywhere, anyone can do it. And whenever I actually looked into it, so where App State is, it's in a pretty rural town in like Western North Carolina. And, you know, it's like, oh, there wouldn't be a Toastmasters in a random middle of nowhere place in Western North Carolina, but there is. And so like, so it's just kind of like, no matter where you're at, there is probably one. And like with what you said, because of technology, you can absolutely do it virtually if there isn't one in your area. And again, I'm so glad that we're just hammering home, like do like wherever you can just communicate. And I feel like once you shift your perspective to being open to those opportunities, you'll recognize and identify more of those opportunities. Because I feel like the reason why a lot of people may have the mindset of, oh, but I've never been approached by like a TV show to feature anything, or like, oh, I've never even been approached to communicate at this thing. Well, I feel like if you shift the mindset of, okay, where can I communicate? It'll really help open your eyes to the opportunities out there. And I feel like open up where you can practice communication. And just a great reminder of just kind of like sticking your head up, looking around, you can identify ways that you can get involved, which is great. And so kind of like going more into your professional communication path and kind of the leadership roles that you held. So you held like great positions in WIC, you have a private practice, as well as you were a professor at Purdue. Is there one experience within these leadership positions that best improved your own communication skills whenever you were a dietitian?
I would say that it relates to what I started with when I was saying communication is a relational activity. And so a big part of where communication can help you succeed is by building relationships wherever you are. Make those connections. One thing that I've always shared with students is I've never applied for a job. Jobs have always come to me. And it's always been because of those connections. My private practice story was just having delivered my first child. the doctor in our from our local area who was going to be her doctor was sitting in my hospital room and asked me what I did. And I said, well, I just finished getting a degree and I'm going to become an RD. And he was like, will you counsel our patients? That's how I started my private practice. Okay. I became involved in our local dietetic association and built connections. From those connections came a part-time job as a consultant dietitian in area nursing homes. That's how I got my WIC position. I could tell story after story after story. And when you make connections, you build relationships, you do a good job at what you do, you get asked to do more of it. And opportunities open up. I was a guest speaker at Purdue many, many years before I got asked to come back and teach. I didn't go apply to work there. The department head calls up and says, would you consider teaching this class? We have a vacancy. Well, let me think about it. Okay. And I didn't say yes to every opportunity that came across my path, but thoughtfully decided, where did I want to go next? And I did a lot of things kind of at the same time. I continued to work at WIC for maybe the first 5 years I was teaching. I can't remember, but I did like things, little part-time things. So it's not one thing at one time, but the one thing was building those relationships.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that just translates over to everything. And like what you said, it translates into every single job that you had. And one question that I do have regarding that is how you never applied to a job. So was that just, did you ever have like something in the back of your mind where your focus was, I'm going to build connections and see where my career goes? Or did it just naturally kind of progress to, oh, I never had to apply to a job and I just realized that? Was it just like kind of, where did that foundation of never having to apply and always being the recipient of job opportunities, do you kind of know where that kind of intention was set, whether it was after or even during the process?
That's a good question that I'm not real sure I know the answer to. Because, I mean, even if you think back to what I was telling you about being a nanny and I cook for families and they suggested that I study a certain thing in college, maybe I'm just not very good at like thinking on my own, but I don't think that's true. I really do kind of have a focus in the same way that I've never taken a clinical position if that was offered. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because that's not my interest.
Yeah.
So I think it's a mindset of being open and knowing the value of connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
People help other people. I always love it when a past student, I taught at Purdue for 16 and a half years, is in touch with me. I still write letters of recommendation. They share with me how they were on TV or something and thank you for teaching me this, or I spoke at my first national conference. Those connections are priceless.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the only reason why I asked is just kind of learning more and seeing how for other people to translate that into where they go in their careers, especially in dietetics. But from what it sounds like, it's more so like you knew the importance of communication and you knew the importance of education. So you placed yourself where your purpose and where you found your passion was and things attracted. And so I think the key takeaway for that is definitely, you know, don't do clinical if you don't want to do clinical, because that won't attract you to jobs that align with your purpose or your goals, to where it's like, if you're honest with yourself and you identify a passion, you identify a niche of dietetics that you want to go down, embrace it, soak it up, do your best. And it sounds like with that mindset and with that purpose, you're opportunities will attract. And I think you're a perfect example of that, just with all your leadership positions, you know, your position at Purdue, your private practice, all of those things. And then I think the last component that I kind of want to ask regarding that is where communicating nutrition fell into play. And so during all of these like things happening, I kind of want to dive deeper into how you helped write and how you were the editor-in-chief for that book. So just kind of like laying the groundwork of where that story began.
So again, this is another example of connections leading one thing to another. So while I was still teaching at Purdue, I had the opportunity, and this was more of like a blanket invitation that went out to people that taught in the nutrition field, where a publishing company was interested in a new book, basic nutrition book for non-majors. And I had taught, one of the courses I had taught at Purdue was that. And I don't know, for some reason I was intrigued. I'd written many curriculums and done quite a bit of writing. I was like, I'll throw my hat in the ring, and it was accepted. So I wrote, let me see, I'll find it on my shelf for those that see the video. It was called Nutrition for Everyone. It was published in 2015. It's no longer being used. Okay. It doesn't take long for a book to kind of like go out of style, so to speak, especially when there's lots of books about that. But that book was a learning environment for how to write a textbook. And it was very immersive, very hard work. Like, it about killed me. Like, I used to tell my friends, like, I will never write another book. Like, shoot me if someone asked me to write a book. Like, I won't do it. But I also had learned the whole process, like every step of a major book. And I had a wonderful development editor that like taught, I kept telling her like, you should write this book. You're so good. But I learned from that. Okay. Well, one of the things that a major book like that has outside reviewers, external reviewers, and I was able to actually name some of them that I would suggest. And so one of the people that I suggested to be an external reviewer was Roberta Dyfe. She's written lots of textbooks in nutrition. And so she was one of the reviewers. She's a longtime colleague, very active in the academy, and she sits on the academy's publishing, like, editorial board of deciding what publications the Academy should produce. And the Academy collects input from practitioners and educators as to what is needed. Well, the Academy had not published a book on communicating nutrition, on anything in nutrition communication, for a couple of decades. And I know that, in fact, the book that they had previous to communicating nutrition, I had actually purchased for my class to have a desk copy, like all the remaining like 20 copies or something. They were on a shelf at Purdue. Okay. So I knew what had been before. And okay, long story short, they were getting a lot of requests for a book in communication. Roberta was on this committee. Roberta had reviewed Nutrition for Everyone that I had written, and she suggested my name, because she knew I had taught nutrition communication. Purdue was one place. I had taken nutrition communication as a student in the 70s. It was one of the universities that had a course in nutrition communication. So I was contacted by the acquisitions editor from the Academy. Would I be interested? Well, that call came just a few months after I had retired from teaching. So the whole dimension of never writing a book again was partly because I was doing it while I was teaching three courses and advising students and doing all kinds of things. Well, when that call came, I was in a very different place, and I was being asked to write something that I knew there was a huge need for, amazing need for. I had wished I'd had a book like that. So I was at a point to say yes. So all the things, all the stars aligned, so to speak. But again, it was building those connections. It was knowing Roberta Dyfe. You know, if someone doesn't know about your work, you're not going to be recommended for something. But again, I didn't apply to that.
Yeah, it was just something that came, and it made perfect sense for, like what you said, the stars aligning, and being given your background in communication, given you've always been interested in communication and education in nutrition, for it to line up perfectly where, yes, you weren't in the headspace to write another book as a professor. You were entering a new stage where you were able to welcome that idea even more, especially for a topic that just aligns so well with your career, with your expertise, and all of those things. And you mentioned like how writing your first book, it was like incredibly difficult, lots of challenges, and just, it was you know, it was hard. And so can you kind of go, just because like for maybe, because I know for me personally, this might be a little selfish where like on like my little like vision board, I really do like, I like the idea of writing a book. Mm-hmm. Writing a book's cool. But it's kind of like, again, like for you, you had to, it had to be presented to you in a way that like it fit your expertise. Like, again, the stars have to align. You don't just write a book to write a book. And so for you, can you kind of describe the challenges that you encountered with your first book, or just kind of like more depth about what made it difficult and just kind of the things that people don't typically hear whenever it comes to writing a book? They kind of see the finished product, but kind of like the nitty gritty.
I mean, we're talking about something that's like 700 pages. Like, take your hardest paper you ever wrote, okay? And just like magnify it. So, and it might depend on the publisher. The Academy was actually more lenient in this area than the publisher for the Nutrition for Everyone. But if I'm not mistaken, I think like any reference couldn't be older than 3 years or something kind of almost ridiculous, unless it was like a classic reference about something. So you were constantly like, oh my gosh, the hours I spent in PubMed. So that is a challenge. And to write it in a way, now again, this was a book for non-majors. Okay. So you had to make it interesting for someone who wasn't studying nutrition as their major. They were taking it as like their science elective or something like that. So how to make it really relevant and trendy and make sense. And you write so many outlines and then so many revisions, and you have to get used to looking at a lot of red ink that the editors send back. And then a reviewer makes a comment and a different reviewer has a totally different idea. So you're trying to incorporate those. It's a huge challenge. It's a lot. And it's over a period of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that it's a long process. It's mainly like most of the time is like knowing what to write rather than the actual like writing piece.
And there's just so much to talk about. I mean, and we have a really good chapter in the book that was written actually by Roberta Dyff. That's the last chapter in the book, chapter 42, that talks about writing a book and some of the challenges, self-publishing versus publishing with a publisher and all of those things, but kind of the process that you go through. And you do it because you have a real heart for giving this communication, this content to that particular audience. And it's mm-hmm. wonderful to be able to put it in writing, that it's there, it's my legacy. It's what I've kind of left with my profession, and someone will take it in the future. It won't have my name on it forever. I hope that it continues to be revised and it continues to be used and used more and more and more, as my hope is that more universities develop a course, and more are, about nutrition communication, not just to use that book, but because it's such an important topic for students to have in their arsenal.
Absolutely. And I think it's great how just, again, like emphasizing the importance of nutrition communication, and like how, again, I think it's great how your first book, Nutrition is for Everyone, what it was about, it is for everyone. And just kind of like communicating it to as many people as humanly possible, and not like, yes, nutrition communication is important, but just it to everyone, not including not just dietitians or not just aspiring dietitians. It is truly for everyone. And kind of going more towards nutrition communication, like the authoritative guide, did you have any key takeaways? Because I'm sure you learned a lot from writing your first book. Was there anything in particular that like stuck out that you kind of used when writing the authoritative guide, like communicating nutrition?
So the development editor was really good at teaching me about how to structure a textbook and how to have very parallel kind of structures within every chapter. I think if you're to look at the book, Communicating Nutrition, you would be very surprised that it was written by 57 different authors. It doesn't have that feel. It has a very cohesive feel, and that's because of how we structured and outlined it. It has the headings and the A heads and the B heads, all of those things that you don't have to know what those are necessarily, but it flows, and every chapter starts with a, why is this important, before we talk about how do you do it, and just the whole setup. And so there were, it's 42 chapters. Well, there was over 42 pages of outline. And that was created with the assistance of those people that had said they wanted to help. But they didn't start writing anything until that was all in place. And it had that cohesive feel. And then one of my jobs was to make sure that they recognized where a topic was also covered in the book and how it was covered. Because sometimes someone would write something, I'd say, you know what, we really covered that in chapter 22. You need to just expand on it about this topic. And then when the art directors got involved, they were very good, and other editors, they were very good about when you read the book, you'll open a page and there'll be these little circles. And I say, you can read more about this in chapter 13, or check out page 427 for more on this topic. And that helped that whole flow of how to make a cohesive book. And so that would be, I think, one of the greatest takeaways that I had. In fact, one time when I was struggling with this, I can still remember the development editor for Nutritionist for Everyone sent me an image of those Russian nesting dolls. Have you ever seen those? We have some, our kids, our grandkids love to play with them. She said, I want you to think of the chapter as that outside doll. And then each of the kind of heading levels is that next doll, and then the next paragraph and the next paragraph, and that concept of it all tying together. And you have that big picture and then the smaller things. And I've thought of that illustration many times.
Yeah, and it's a great visual. And like how you mentioned, 57 people put effort into that one book. And I'm sure that was like incredibly, you know, that had its own challenges, like organizing and keeping it still cohesive. And so for you, given like your experience, and then because you said that you started working on this after you retired from Purdue, right? And so as far as whenever, you know, you kind of shifted into this new phase of your life where you were able to put energy and put more effort into writing this book, how did you stay motivated, especially to like leading in this book and leading 57 people in the process? Like where did your motivation come from? And like, how did you stay organized with that many people on this book?
Well, sometimes there were probably days that I was pulling out my hair and thinking, why did I do this? But I kept coming back to how needed this book was. I wanted this book to be out for students like yourself and every student coming after you to have this resource. And a little background in how we got 57 people. When I was asked to do it, I could have written it by myself. I wasn't asked to go look for other people to help me. Okay. So when the acquisitions editor and I talked about it, I said, you know, I'm not an expert in all of these areas of nutrition communication. Sure, I taught them, but I would often have a guest speaker that would come in and teach about certain things. And there are so many people out in our field that do this. Let's see if we can get some of them to help us. So one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and it's a big part of one section of the book, is doing what we call a needs assessment. So you don't just write something, you figure out what the audience that you're going to write this for needs. And so we did a survey with, actually more than one survey, with I think 6 or 7 practice groups that are related to either education, educating future dietitians, or practicing dietitians that have some relationship to communicating. Okay. And so it was hundreds and hundreds, thousands of, not all 100,000, but thousands of a subset that had that specific interest. One of the questions that we had at the end of that survey that was collecting what needs to be in the content, how to deliver it, et cetera, was, would you be interested in helping write or review? And we had dozens and dozens, actually several hundred people say, pick me. So then there was that whole process of what's your area of expertise. Out of those 57 people, I only knew 7 of them before we started. I didn't pick and choose them or invite. They volunteered. They did that for no money. Okay. Nobody was paid to write that book. So that says a lot. These people were all passionate. Some people helped with one chapter. Some people helped with multiple chapters. I actually was a part writer on, I think it was like 18 chapters, and I wrote a couple of them by myself. But it led to a richer book with so many different experiences included, and it just made it so much better. And everyone has some different perspectives. Yes, it added to the challenge. But actually, I like organizing things, and I like organizing groups and people and developing spreadsheets. And these are our deadlines. And the book doesn't get written from chapter one to chapter 42. You bounce around. That's a whole nother story. But I enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed getting to know those people on both a personal and professional level. I believe over the course of the 4 years that we wrote the book, I think 8 babies were born to the authors. So, I mean, life happens. We had a few crises, but it was so much better book. And then you had all these people that really, in a sense, helped market the book. They helped tell the story, helped share it with their part of the world, and be cheerleaders for it.
Yeah, and I think
a benefit.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and I think just the whole, like, given that 57 people were involved with the book, it's a great, like, representation and symbol of just, like, with what you said, how relationships are so important and how relationships build to bigger and better things, because you were able to have, yeah, like, yes, you had to put in some more effort to organize 57 people instead of just yourself writing the book, but you knew from the get-go because of how motivated and passionate you were about the subject, you were like, for this to be a good book, multiple people with different perspectives, more expertise in like certain categories of communication would make this a better book. And not only that, but them volunteering to do it. Like, there's just so many layers to it, showing like how much love and energy was put into this one book. And again, shameless plug, why everyone should at least read it once in their life, just because of how much effort, like blood, sweat, and tears went into it with those 4 years. And so, like, yeah, it's just a great story, not even just the book itself, but a story of how it came to be, the people who worked on it. It's just a great representation of what nutrition communication and communication in general is all about. And so, kind of like, not winding down, but just kind of going more towards like, to what listeners can take away and what listeners can learn from nutrition communication, or just things that they can be more aware of moving forward after listening to this podcast. And so we've already talked a lot about the fact that nutrition communication isn't really a topic that's educated as much. Like, for example, in our DPD coursework, we have nutrition education and we take a generic public speaking class, but that's kind of the big gist of what nutrition communication is kind of covered. But is there anything else that you believe is not spoken enough about in dietetics, or just kind of a specific niche of communication, or just anything in general that you feel like isn't spoken enough about in dietetics?
I don't know if we don't speak about it. We haven't. What I'm going to mention is I thought was the best answer to this question. We've just started speaking about, and that is our lack of diversity in our profession. And that's something that's going to take really quite some time and effort to turn it around. It doesn't just happen all of a sudden. And that's not something that is just in our profession. In probably most professions, there's a lack of diversity, and that lack is going to vary. We don't have enough men in our profession, in the same way that my daughter's a chemist and there aren't very many females in that profession. It used to be kind of funny when you taught at Purdue University, and this is probably the same in lots of places, you would teach in some other building across campus. And so you'd be standing outside some lecture hall in the physics building or something. And I'm standing out there with a whole lot of young women and one or two guys, and some other class would walk out and it was like all men. And the professor would look at me and he'd go, "What do you teach?" I'd say, "Dietetics." He'd say, "I teach engineering." And so we have a problem both ways, okay? And And there'll probably always be some dimension of an affinity for things. But when it comes to a practice where, similar to medicine, where medicine has really diversified, okay, I think it's more women are in medicine now than men, and all different races and ethnicities. We probably haven't made it as affordable as we should for some underrepresented groups, but we need to do the same thing in our profession, because people, when they need healthcare and when they need help with something like how to eat, it can be really very helpful if that person is maybe of that same culture or ethnic group or religious group or whatever it is that might impact their food choices. And in the meantime, before we have that diversity, we need to be students of culture. And one of the cultures that I worked with for many years, because I worked with in the WIC program, is people of a lower socioeconomic group. And so my heart has always been in helping limited resource audiences. And if you yourself aren't a limited resource audience person, you need to walk in their shoes, and you need to understand the barriers that they have and the challenges that they have to put food on the table. And so you need to become a student of the culture of the people you serve. And we need to do more of that in our instruction to help our students to appreciate and understand the diversity of cultures.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you focus on us being like students of culture and just learning more about culture, because whenever you think about, and you brought up so many great points about the increasing diversity, whenever it comes to targeting like the root of it, it's more so culture itself and understanding and empathy, and like in that culture is more than just one certain identifying, like, you know, it's not just race, it's race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. It's so many different things that make a person who they are, and all of them are just as important as the other. And it's great to look at the bigger picture than just like one single factor and like, you know, just one thing. It's definitely a multifactorial thing. And I think you worded it so great to learn not just about the person, but about the culture, where they came from, the context, because that's going to be how we can communicate with more people and how we can reach more people throughout our profession, which is really great. And so, again, we've just covered so many great things regarding communication, regarding education, nutrition, writing a book, just so many great things that people can take away from this episode. But if anyone just wants to become a better nutrition, like communicator, particularly in nutrition, because again, like this is a dietetics podcast, so, you know, kind of tailoring it to that, what is one tangible step dietetic students or new RDs, really anyone, can take now to become an effective communicator in dietetics? And of course, plug the book, read the book. That's of course a great step to do as well. But just if there's like a tangible step someone could do today to become a better communicator.
Well, again, I would certainly invite anyone to visit my website. I have all kinds of free resources and tip sheets, and I encourage you to follow the any kind of social media thing that I'm involved in, and especially the student group. We have Talk Nutrition for Students is an Instagram page that I've been doing for 4 years, ever since we published the book. Each year, it's a new team of students, and they create the content. We meet over Zoom. I've only met a few of them in person, and they've been from around the world. This year, we have a student from Ghana. And so obviously those kind of things would be great. Again, join my Toastmasters Club. But on a more just very specific note, be intentional about any communication endeavor that or opportunity that you have. You're a student or an intern. You're going to have to give a presentation, or maybe you were asked to write a newsletter article or whatever. Put your heart into it. Figure out, how can I do this really well? And learn from whoever gives you suggestions, and ask your peers, well, how would you make this different? You know, work on each thing and build those skills. Jump in, just like Ellie Krieger said, jump into the ring. Any opportunity that you have, just do it, learn from it, and another opportunity will come. Doors will open. You will have the opportunity to communicate. Do it well, learn to do it better, keep learning, keep doing. That's really it.
Yeah, doing it well and learning to do it better is just a great, it's like such a great thing to end on, and just being more intentional and like knowing that there are opportunities to communicate better and to just putting your all into those opportunities. So yeah, thank you so much, Barb, for just sitting down today, talking to us about so many great aspects of your career, things that you learned, the book that everyone should read, and just, yeah, thank you so much. And I know that a lot of people will learn a lot of great things on this podcast, but again, thank you for taking the time to talk about it all.
You are so welcome. I enjoyed it. I always enjoy doing these.